Hi, I'm Sam Dingman, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the annual Battle of the Bands between ASU and the U of A isn't a competition, or is it? And envisioning a future where we take refuge from climate change in shopping malls. But first, with tensions escalating between the U.S. and Venezuela, KJZZ's Nina Krivinsky has been reporting on how the situation is impacting America's relationship with Mexico. Cartel violence continues to ravage families south of the border, and some of the people impacted by it are clamoring for U.S. intervention. Nina joins me now with the latest on this tense dynamic. Nina, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. At the beginning of a piece that you did on this recently, we meet a young woman named Crystal Langford, whose life has been upended by cartel violence. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so listeners might remember this story, the massacre of nine independent Mormons in Sonora in 2019. It was big international news, and it put cartel violence in Mexico into this global spotlight. Crystal was 18 that day, and her two young brothers and her mother were killed when perpetrators largely believed to be members of the brutal La Línea faction of the Juarez cartel ambushed their vehicle. 6 years later, Crystal herself is a mother now. She has a seven-month-old, but obviously this grief is still really present in her life. You know, she says that not only was she ripped from her mother and brothers that day, but also her home, the small town in the Sierra Madre Mountains in Sonora, Mexico, where she grew up. She doesn't like going back because she says it's too strange to be there without her mom.
So, Nina, Crystal told you that she would like to see the Trump administration get involved in pursuing justice against the cartel. What exactly does she have in mind?
Yeah, so she has a really specific ask. She wants the Trump administration to designate the Juarez cartel and La Línea as foreign terrorist organizations. The administration earlier this year designated several other Mexican drug cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. So if that happened, these two additional groups would join this growing list.
So the idea that the administration would designate the cartels as foreign terrorist organizations, this calls to mind the justifications that we have heard for the controversial boat strikes that they have carried out in Venezuela. What exactly does this designation do?
Yeah, so you're right. These have been in the news a lot. Just this week, the Trump administration handed down another FTO designation on an organization called Carteles Soles, which they say is led by Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Analysts say that could be part of a strategy, this designation, to lay the groundwork for more direct attacks on Venezuela. We've seen a big recent buildup of U.S. firepower off of Venezuela in warships and aircraft carriers off the coast. Experts tell me that an FTO designation doesn't give the administration some kind of sweeping authority to invade a country without congressional approval. But that terrorism word certainly pops up a lot when you hear the president and administration officials talk about Venezuela, including these strikes on alleged drug boats that have killed dozens of people in the Caribbean Sea and East Pacific.
Yes. Well, as I mentioned, the strikes have been controversial, and we've even heard in recent days that some of the president's allies are uncomfortable with them. How has the administration defended the strikes? And tell us a bit more about the pushback that you've heard from your sources on their rationale.
Yeah, so the administration categorizes these strikes as a deterrent method. Why would you run a drug boat up these routes if there's a non-zero chance that the U.S. military will blow you out of the water? But the military has released very little information about who exactly is on these boats. You know, experts tell me that they're most likely not kingpins or high-up cartel leaders. And of course, these people have not stood for a trial. They're being killed by the U.S. without necessarily being convicted of any crime, which is why many human rights experts I've talked to are calling these strikes extrajudicial killings, which are illegal under international law.
Well, so circling back now to the situation in Mexico, Nina, there have been headlines recently about President Trump threatening military action there. What is the latest on that situation, and how is this FTO designation related?
Yeah, so Trump has suggested throughout his administration that he wouldn't rule out a strike on Mexico. Last week, he said in response to a question about that it would be okay with him if it helps stop drugs coming into the U.S. But Secretary of State Marco Rubio has said the U.S. will not be acting unilaterally toward Mexico. So experts tell me there's sort of a spectrum of opinions of people close to the president on this topic.
And we should say, obviously, the U.S. relationship with Mexico, very different than its relationship with Venezuela. Nina, you and I have talked before about Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum's generally positive dynamic with Trump. What do we know about her reaction to Trump's threats?
Yeah, you're right. So Sheinbaum and Trump have been able, like we've talked about, to negotiate on trade and security issues. But since the beginning of the Trump administration, Sheinbaum has drawn a really clear line in the sand. Her administration will collaborate and coordinate with the U.S., but it won't stand for unilateral military action, like a drone strike or U.S. operatives working inside the country without coordination from Mexico. So far, she's been able to maintain that good relationship largely and stave off military action and a lot of Trump's tariff threats, partially by helping the U.S. with things it wants, like the transfer of several high-profile prisoners to the U.S. to face prosecution. But one expert I talked to put it this way: the Trump administration will keep asking Mexico for things. And some people in the Sheinbaum administration worry that eventually their country will run out of deliverables.
Well, just about 30 seconds left here, Nina. And lest we make this all about high-level diplomacy, you actually asked Crystal Langford, whose family was killed in the cartel violence, for her opinion on all this. What did she tell you?
Yeah, I mean, mostly what she wants is justice for the people who did this to her family. She, like many people who have had their loved ones killed by cartels in Mexico, feels the pace of getting that justice has been too slow. What she wants now is for the U.S. to do more to speed up that process and crack down on cartels.
Well, that is KJZZ's Nina Kravinsky reporting from Hermosillo. Nina, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam.
Bragging rights between ASU and the U of A are on the line this Friday, and not just because the school's respective football teams will face off in the annual Territorial Cup game. There will also be a battle of the bands, the Sun Devil Marching Band against U of A's Pride of Arizona Marching Band. Every year, earlier in the day before the football game, the two bands perform their original shows at a local high school in the game's host city. This year, they'll be appearing at Marcos Denisa High School in Tempe. Now, much like a quarterback makes a game plan, so too does the drum major of a marching band before a halftime show. For an inside look at that process, I recently sat down with the head drum major of the Sun Devil Marching Band, Corey Yeager. Now, I should say, we also reached out to the U of A band, but didn't get a response. So Corey and I focused on his nuanced approach to the Battle of the Bands, which he assured me is not technically a competition.
We call it Battle of the Bands, right? But it's more of an exhibition for both of us, right? The U of A will come up here and they'll play their show first. We'll play our show second. And it's just kind of an opportunity for us to get together. So it's just a great opportunity to kind of show off what the marching arts looks like at the collegiate level, right? In Arizona, we have two different circuits that do marching band, ABOTA and AZMBA, and the high schools compete during that. I went to Sandra Day O'Connor High School,
Okay.
so I was competitive in that, right? Competitive marching band, things like that. We don't do that at the collegiate level. And I think that a lot of kids, when they get out of high school, they don't know what's next. So it's just an opportunity for people to kind of see what we do,
Yeah.
right? And it's a recruiting tool.
Okay. Can I ask you, I mean, when you were doing it in high school,
Yes.
how much of the appeal for you was the competitive element?
When I was in high school, I would think about the competitive aspect, and I would review the judges' sheets, and I would say, okay, when we go to rehearsal, this is what we need to focus on. This is what
Okay.
we need to do. This is what we need to do.
Like review judges' sheets from previous years or
Yes.
previous
Yes,
competitions.
from previous competitions and the judges' tapes as well. So they have judges that they have like the five for the five categories, like music ensemble, things like that. So I would say that it was a big part of what I was bought into, but I would say more for me, I love sports. I'm a huge fan of letting the band play the fight song. I think it's what makes college athletics college athletics, especially in the ever-changing environment of what college athletics is now with, you know, name, image, likeness, and all the things, the transfer portal, things like that.
That's interesting. There is something uniquely amateur college sports mm-hmm. about having a marching band and a fight song that
That's
is
right.
unique to that institution.
That's right. Yeah. And people spend 4 years at their university, right? And they buy into it, I would say, more than you would with a major sports team, especially with, you know, 55,000 people in the stadium. Touchdown score, right? Guy breaks off for 30, 40-yard touchdown. Place is going crazy. Play fight song. Play the fight song.
Right.
Let the band play. That's it. It brings people together.
Brings people together.
Yes.
It is interesting to me, though. It's one thing to be in the band.
Mm-hmm.
It's another thing to lead the band.
Yes.
What do you like about leading the band?
Yes. Well, the biggest thing for me is that it's not so much about being in front of people, right? The reason why I drum major and why I'm so passionate about it is because I'm passionate about the relationships that it can create for people. My best friends, I met my freshman year of high school, and we're still best friends to this day. Text all the time. I lived with them last year. It's really important to me.
And you met them through band?
I did. Yes.
Okay.
I met them through band. They're my best friends. Being able to build that connection for people matters to me. And I want people to have that opportunity to meet their best friends, to meet, you know, maybe their partner, things like that. I met my girlfriend in marching band. We were drum majors together in high school. So,
oh, wow. I want to see that movie.
yeah, right? So it matters, right? People might just think about, oh, here comes the marching band. But it's the product that you work together to build through the year, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, whenever your rehearsal schedule is, continually getting better, that builds that relationship. And when it's time for the season to end or it gets close to the end, you really buy into it and you say, you know what? We had a great year. We had a great year. I'm coming back, right? This matters to me. So
you, if I'm hearing you right, you like being a steward of that.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So coming back to the Battle of the Bands, mm-hmm. even if it's not a formal competition, mm-hmm. level with me.
Oh, yeah.
Is there some sense of rivalry just for you personally mm-hmm. or within the band? Like, do you want to put on a better show than
absolutely.
U of A?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And I'm sure people down south can tell you the exact same, is that when you get into the rivalry, you might not understand it at first. And for me, I came to ASU. I think we had won, I don't know how many years in a row that we had held the cup for. And it was a huge point. They had a billboard set up on the way down to Tucson. How many years we had won in a row, and they had to come up and look at it. And it was just a big deal, right? And we went down there my first year, and we lost.
Oof.
And it's challenging.
Hubris.
Yeah. And their fans are passionate about it. They call it hate week, right? Hate week, rivalry
oh,
week. I mean, it's a big deal.
It's a thing, yeah.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. So, of course, we want to put on a better show, and we'll always tell you that, yeah, man, we got them this year. We got them this year.
Uh-huh.
And they're going to say the same thing.
Uh-huh.
We got them this year. We got them this year. So it's just it's fun. It's fun, but of course we do. Of course we want to show that we're a better band, and of course I think that's true, but they have a great program.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, and we gave them the opportunity to come in here and do this as a three-way conversation, so they're not here, so you can say whatever you want. but what does that look like for you as drum major? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously you're there in rehearsal,
mm-hmm.
but are you then in your off time— Are you like reviewing video? What mm-hmm. What does that process look
yeah,
like?
Yeah, all the time. All the time. We use this app called UDB, Ultimate Drill Book. And it's what sets all of our dots. And I go through it. I watch the dots. I watch how it comes together. I watch how it lines up to the music.
And tell people who might not know who are listening what drill is and what the dots are.
Yeah. So drill is basically what you see on the field. Like that's the product, right? So
mm-hmm.
page 1 to 2, we're going to move 4 steps to the right. We're going to move 4 steps to the left, right? So we'll go, all right, let's go page 1 to 2. It's going to be however many counts to get there. So I think our closer has about 27 pages of drill. So just, yeah, something to,
wow.
That's what drill is, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. So on this app, you're watching how it's supposed to go.
How it's supposed to go.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, it's a digital Like it's got the fake little guys on there that
okay.
we watch. So.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So then you have that in your head next time you're with the band.
Yes.
And you know the marks that they need to be hitting.
Yes, yes.
And do you have the music memorized?
I do. Yeah, actually I do. And as a drum major, I spend a lot of time with the percussion uh-huh. part as well. That's where I find my time from. Uh-huh. So I'm very, very familiar with the percussion part.
How do you memorize the music? Does it just happen? Or do you have a prescribed method you use?
It's just listening to it over and over again. Yeah. I got about a 40-minute drive in mm-hmm. To school.
Okay.
So just over and over again, just listening to it, just listening, you know, where am I? Okay, this is then, this is happening then. Okay, this needs to be bigger here, things like that, right?
So do members of the two bands hang out together after the Battle of the Bands?
So we spend about probably maybe a half an hour just doing like a little meet and greet. You know, hey, how was your season? Things mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. So
it is notable to me that it's like, yeah, we hang out. We spend about 30 minutes together.
Yeah. Yeah. We try. We really do. We really do try. Uh-huh. I try and take my rivalry cap off just to be respectful, and they yeah. deserve it as well.
Corey Yeager is the head drum major for ASU's Sun Devil Marching Band. Corey, thank you for this conversation and good luck on Friday.
All right. Thanks so much.
Good morning and welcome back from just about halftime here on the show at KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, why malls could be more than collapsing corporate monuments.
I really started thinking, whoa, this is a place that I could go when the next wildfire hits here in the Bay Area, because it's sort of like a climate bunker hiding in plain sight.
We'll hear why one writer is thinking about malls in a different way. But first, earlier this year, we put the show on stage at Crescent Ballroom in downtown Phoenix. And of course, we had to include a Sunday evening version of our Friday newscap. My co-host Mark Brody spoke with political consultants Stacey Pearson and Chuck Coughlin, and it was a raucous conversation filled with analysis, predictions, and plenty of one-liners.
How you guys doing?
Good.
A little intimidating.
Usually when we do this...
can throw things at me.
When we do this, we're usually in a padded room by ourselves.
Right.
Like, the only danger is, like, one of the three of us is going to, like, hit each other or something.
Well, that's
Sneeze.
Happened on occasion. As well.
Just with you, Chuck.
Yeah,
just with you.
Sorry.
All right. So let's start sort of a broad question. Stacey, I'll start with you. How would you describe the current state of politics in this state?
I mean, it's fine.
Yeah.
I don't know why we're here. Everyone,
Could
go
you
home.
Ask for anything better?
Everyone, go home. We are in an environment where rage is monetized by our tech companies. And until we get a handle on that, these comments from our elected officials, not our president, mind you, but other elected officials, who are telling folks to turn the temperature down, it's not going to happen. Like, it's rage now, and then second to what sells is sex. So, I mean, rage sits above that, and it's not until we figure out a way to get a handle on that through the tech companies. This is bad.
Chuck, what do you think?
Yeah, she's right. I mean, the currency of politics today is contempt. So the best thing we all can do about that is check our own at the door, right? And just try and treat, you know, the old admonition is still true today. Love your neighbor as yourself. And we all got to check ourselves about that kind of stuff. But that's how we'll begin to turn this around. And, you know, I've noted that, you know, most of these acts that are going on right now are perpetrated by younger people who, you know, have been socialized on the internet. And she's right about that. And so we have a challenge in our culture today on how to deal with that phenomena. I don't know that it's going to go away anytime soon, but we all have to work hard at that. I thought Spencer Cox, the governor of Utah, did a good job the other day in speaking to that issue. I was, you know, next to Kash Patel. He was like a long, cool drink of water on a hot summer day. So that was good. I enjoyed that, and we need more of that.
Well, so short of, like, flooding TikTok with, like, puppy and kitten videos. Like, how do we do this? Because it seems to me you're probably not going to get the majority of people offline, right? Like, people are not going to stop doom scrolling and looking at whatever social media they're looking at. They're not going to stop looking at YouTube. So what do we do about this?
So immeasurable failure of my party was assuming that the kids were always going to be with us. We left not a lane open for the Charlie Kirks of the world. We let a freeway open for them. You know, my daughter's 22. She doesn't remember a world where marriage equality didn't exist. Like, she doesn't remember that she was born after 9/11. Like, her dad's a cop. My husband, we've got a mixed, pretty wild political household. But he's also a Democrat and the president of his union. So you guys want to come to Thanksgiving? It's super fun with my MAGA in-laws. It's awesome, which is the best part about this.
She
is
did
that
it
I'm
before
not
me.
I did. Stacey swear first. To.
This right. was not on awesome. The bingo card.
For me to jump first. But 22-year-olds don't remember. And the Democrats took these kids for granted. And so we put them on video games. They're not playing volleyball. We charge families $300 a month for their kids to play sports. And they are desocialized, to Chuck's point. They are socialized on the internet. And the Democrats, I don't know what we were doing. What were we doing?
Well, so Chuck, this kind of raises the question, because we've seen both here in Arizona and around the country sort of a political realignment, right? Like, groups that have not been traditionally associated with one political party are moving in that direction and vice versa. Do you think this is a permanent thing, or do you think it's sort of cyclical as it has seemed to have been in past decades?
So Donald, my colleague at work, calls Donald Trump a one-headed unicorn, you know, because there's only one of him. And how that evolves after this cycle is going to be a critically important question, and how the Democrats evolve around that and how to respond to that. But for the time being, it is that. And I don't recognize either party anymore. I mean, the party, I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. You know, dad was a corporate labor lawyer in Detroit. That was the conversation at the dinner table every night. Mom had opinions, and she was always right. And so... that was the household I grew up in. And so, but it was pretty well fixed, even though my safety patrol was right next to the Ann Arbor 5 house that they dug the bomb crater in front of the house for the Hanoi bomb crater. But, you know, it was, I could get that. I don't get it anymore. I don't get, it's this culture of contempt that we live in right now. That's not something that is, it's completely foreign to me. And, you know, my only response to that, go to church on Sunday, you know, have my peace there, get inspired there, you know, by those admonitions that we encourage ourselves with. And that's where I get my peace.
Do you think the realignment that we've seen nationally is as significant in Arizona as we've seen in other places?
Well, we are turning points home here in Arizona.
I would say worse.
And so we are on the edge of that curve. We're on the leading edge of that curve. I mean, when you know, I said this the other day, you know, we don't remember that Turning Point was responsible for beating Rusty Bowers. I mean,
Arizona House Speaker.
Yeah, when he was the Speaker of the House. I've known Rusty for 30 years. Artist, coolest guy, and, you know, Mormon, but awesomely cool guy. Very smart, very erudite. Stephen Richer, you know, we like Stephen.
Former county recorder.
Liked having his hair up there. and both of them got taken out by Turning Point over election denialism. But Turning Point has embraced that narrative. It's not how it started. It's not how Turning Point started. But they have embraced that narrative. And so they're here. They've essentially taken over the Republican Party in Arizona by virtue of having precinct committeemen become our Turning Point people becoming precinct committeemen. I've talked to a former chairman, and they're like, these people are joining. They've never voted. You know, these are their first time. They're coming into, and they're organized under the Republican banner. Gina Swoboda, the chairman of the Republican Party, is getting pushed, you know, by the Turning Point people. She wanted to run for Secretary of State. She's worked for Katie Hobbs in the Secretary of State's office. She's a very, very smart woman.
Very sane woman.
Yeah, and she got pushed out because they're going to have a Turning Point guy run. And so that's the kind of the avant-garde place we're living in right now. And that's going to be this 26th cycle. And my suspicion is that the events of the last week will highly motivate those constituencies to the benefit of those folks.
That is my co-host Mark Brody speaking with Stacey Pearson and Chuck Coughlin. We'll hear more of their conversation after the break. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Let's return to our onstage edition of the Friday Newscap from our show at Crescent Ballroom earlier this year. Here's my co-host Mark Brody with Chuck Coughlin and Stacey Pearson.
Stacey, we've seen voter registration numbers in this state
Totally fine.
Yeah, nothing to see here. How big of a problem is that for Democrats?
It's catastrophic. I mean, of all of the swing states, Arizona's lost more Democrats than any other swing state. The folks that are moving here from California, Washington, Oregon, are intentionally not registering as Democrats. And we as a party, we as a group, have somehow just assumed everything's going to be okay. It's fine. Everybody's going to come home. Everything's great. It's fine. It's not fine. Things are not fine. The house is on fire. And we continue to refuse to acknowledge that. And it's folks who, I always talk about my neighbors. I scan the crowd to make sure they weren't here. Yeah. But I talk about them all the time. They're two Stanford-educated folks, live in Arcadia. I'm so white. My west side is
privileged.
So not okay with this. But anyway, they went to Stanford. They moved in next door. They both registered as independents. And it was about homelessness. They moved from Southern California. They were super pissed off about the fact that there were folks that they couldn't park at their beach park. And as Democrats, we started to demonize that statement. They're pro law enforcement. They want the guy screaming at the clouds to get help. And we changed words. We started to call folks unsheltered neighbors. And they're like, you know what? That's not my neighbor. That guy was barking at your dog through my fence, and I'm mad. We detached in a way that is really unfortunate. And in Arizona, the numbers matter, man. I worked on the Pennzone campaign in 2012. I ran it in 16 when he won. And we had to find a Trump-McCain anti-Arpaio voter. And the guy that employed me at the time was like, you're insane. Yeah, probably, but we're also going to do it. We're looking at those kind of numbers. We're looking at the state going back a decade and a half, two decades.
You're looking at a cycle on a turnout cycle. So the last cycle, in the presidential cycle, we were anticipating a +3 Republican turnout. So that's 3% more Republicans than Democrats, and quite a bit more than independents, because independents don't perform at their registration margins. But a 3-point it was 9. So there was 9 percentage more Republicans. That was in a presidential cycle, which is often
with an unpopular guy.
Yeah, often younger, much younger. And so roll forward into the off cycle, into the gubernatorial cycle, where those numbers tend to double. So it's going to be a double-digit Republican turnout advantage on the statewide ballot. Mm. And that will make a significant difference. My problem, as she's just been talking about, is what are Democrats voting for? I know what they're voting against. I know I can talk about that. But what are they voting for? And what are those things that bring independents and unaffiliated voters who are generally want to be problem solvers, you know, sort of fiscally conservative, a little bit more socially liberal? What are we doing to bring those people to the table? And my fear is, in this cycle, is that's not happening.
That's fine. It's great.
Yeah, it's great.
You just keep saying that, Stacey. It seems like you're maybe trying to convince yourself.
It's her therapy.
All right, so guys, I want to do a little fill in the blank. We have just a few minutes left, so I'm going to do a little fill in the blank for both of you. Okay, ready? The race for blank will be the most expensive one in the state next year. Stacey, what do you think?
Man, next year we don't have a Senate.
For the first time in like forever.
Right.
Yeah.
Probably, I mean, the race for governor is going to be the most expensive that we've ever seen.
Yeah.
And trying the outside money, the forces, thankfully, nationally, the forces recognize that Arizona is getting redder. We are not purpler. We're definitely not blue. And so there's a scenario where every, given Chuck's voter registration statistics, every single statewide office is at risk. All five. That they're all. So there's going to be so much money spent.
Hopefully. Chuck, do you agree with that?
I agree. I think the gubernatorial race will be expensive. The attorney general's race will be expensive. The secretary of state's race will be expensive. I mean, we'll see what happens on the CorpCom. The Turning Point's trying to knock out the two Republicans in the primary. So we'll see what happens there. But and the same thing on the superintendent of public instruction. All those statewide races, we'll see a lot of money spent.
All right. So looking a little bit earlier, we're a little less than a year away from the primaries. The blank primary will be the ugliest next year. Chuck, I'll start with you. And I'm sorry to make you pick just one, because I suspect that your answer would be all of them.
So you're looking for a specific race that's
just for the office. You don't have to name the candidates. For the office.
I mean, right off the top of my head, I'm just going to go with it, is the Republican primary for governor is going to be a knockdown. Karen, I know Karen. She used to be a client.
Karen Taylor Robeson.
Karen Taylor Robeson has a ton of money. Ed has done well with his life. And so she's going to spend, you know, clearly more than $10 to $15 million. And how she executes on that with Mr. Biggs is going to be incredibly important. Because Mr. Biggs is not Carrie Lake. He's not going to make the stupid mistakes that she made. He's going to execute on a much more disciplined, button-down campaign, rolling around with his Turning Point friends, and not being outrageous. He will try to check himself. It may be the first time that I ever witness him. So, I have a long history with the former congressman. We almost got in a fist
fight. Current congressman.
Yeah. We almost got in a fist fight in the legislature in 2014.
Oh, wow.
It was 2003 when he was trying to sabotage the Prop 400, which was the next half-cent sales tax election back then. And he was trying to sabotage that, and Jake Flake had to break us up.
See what y'all miss by not being at the Capitol on a daily basis? Stacey, what do you think? What's going to be the ugliest primary next year?
The CD1 race, you know, we've got everybody who's ever registered as a Democrat in Arcadia, Scottsdale, Biltmore area running for that seat. Stupid. Like, what are you... Like, can five of you figure out which three of you... Like, I'm all about robust primaries, but what are we doing? Like, there's... I don't know. I think there's...
You're killing yourselves.
I'm not even kidding. I think there are 11 people in that primary right now. Like, someone go sit down. Like, you go sit down. Like, you... Read, you know, when you go to your eye doctor and you have to read the things at distance, everyone stand here and read at a distance. And anyone who can't get through the sentence, go sit down. And if you know how to use it, yeah, like I want everyone in that primary needs to know how to download an app on their iPhone. I don't want IQ tests anymore. Like, I don't want acuity tests. I want someone to figure out, like, my mother's remote. Like...
So you're saying CD1 on the Democratic side.
Yeah, it annoys me. Yeah, clearly. I don't know if I've mentioned that.
You'd never know.
I'd know.
All right, last one. We're about running out of time, so last fill in the blank. And I'll phrase it in a not fill in the blank form, but obviously both the Democratic and Republican parties in the state have had their share of turmoil over the last, let's say, 6 to 8 months. Which of the parties going into next year will be more unified and organized? Stacey?
That's cute. You actually made Chuck crack up. Like, that's...
Mission accomplished.
I mean, obviously, we're going to get it together in 400 days. Like, we're going to be a unified group of people. The beautiful thing is we were never expected to be. So, like, the...
The bar is low, then, as you're saying.
Yeah.
You could shuffle over it.
Yeah. As Chuck mentioned earlier, you could shuffle over the bar the Democrats have set in terms of organization and unification. But... The good news is the governor's team I know well, and they're very smart, and they've Secretary of State and the AG's office, they've just gone right around it. So they're like, you know what, you fight amongst yourselves, you kids take it from here. In the meantime, let's go. And so I'm hoping it's that we get our together, proverbial.
Yeah.
But
Chuck, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the Republicans will have their their proprietary
different
stuff
four-letter
together.
Word. Thank you.
They'll have their things together better because there's less of a division there. There is a division. Let's be clear. There's your Turning Point crowd that is the, you know, the ground troops for MAGA, and then there's elements of the Republican Party that are still somewhat recognizable from the past that are around Gina and those folks, but they unify around Trump. I mean, that is what they are unified around. And, you know, without a counter-narrative, and Trump's doing his best to create the counter-narrative, I'll give you that, but if that doesn't develop, then it's an easy walkthrough.
All right, guys, we'll have to leave it there. Chuck Coughlin, Stacey Pearson, thanks to you both for being here. Thanks for taking part in this crazy experiment. Thank you.
That was our special onstage edition of the show's Friday Newscap. Stay tuned for more info about live Radiohead's events in 2026. Good morning. It's our Thanksgiving Eve edition of the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Over the last generation, it became something of a trend to hate the mall.
I think it's come to symbolize everything people think about as having gone wrong in America. Suburban sprawl, consumer excess, really bad taste. I think it was seen as tacky and soulless. And just really removed from any living urban fabric.
That is psychotherapist and writer Elizabeth Dyer. In a recent conversation with my co-host Lauren Gilger, Dyer said she knows that hating the mall has become almost a moral position in recent years. But in a new piece for Next City, she argues that in a climate change future, maybe we should look at the mall in a new way as a bunker. Lauren spoke with her more about it.
Across the country, malls are sort of quietly doubling as cooling centers during heat waves and smoke shelters during wildfires. And when I visited one recently with my young kids who are 4 and 7, I really started thinking, whoa, this is a place that I could go when the next wildfire hits here in the Bay Area, because it's sort of like a climate bunker hiding in plain sight. I think it's sort of performing the collective protective role almost that public infrastructure no longer is really providing reliably.
That's so interesting. So there's a climate future kind of aspect to this where literally you call them like they could be bunkers. And I think people have used them that way. Californians were told to go to malls during some of the worst wildfires, right? I mean,
yeah,
is this true. Something you think is already kind of happening, even though no one's really calling it this?
So according to my research, it's pretty informal, but just from observation and also from having published this piece and getting so many responses from friends and people I didn't even know who talked about going to the mall in times of climate strife and emergency, I do think it is something that's happening. I think it's a phenomenon that is happening.
Okay, so there's that part of it, the climate part of it. But what you're also getting at here, I think, is very interesting, which is sort of a defense of the mall as a third space, a place of togetherness in a world in which, you know, we're all very siloed and often don't even ever have to be in the same place at the same time, because you can order your groceries and have them delivered. You can order your clothes and have them delivered. Like, those places where we're all actually in public are becoming fewer and far between.
Yes, that really is sort of the heart of the piece for me. It's both about the mall as this really surprising refuge from climate change, but also a refuge from sort of the worst new wave of neoliberal optimization. Mm. You know, the mall's refuge isn't only physical. I think it really is this kind of third space. It sort of resists the optimization that we have become so accustomed to when we act as consumers online, where we're really routed and measured and funneled with really a scary amount of cold logic behind it. The mall is just this hapless, you know, Claire's fitted space with a dinky little fountain and kids throwing pennies in still. It feels very innocent and very different from the digital experiences of consumerism that I think we've become accustomed to.
Yeah. You write about your own kind of childhood experiences at the mall. I had a very similar experience where it was like the place where I could pretend to be a grown-up almost. Tell us about what this was like in your memory, at least at malls.
Yeah, it's such a crisp memory, and I love that it's one that so many of us share. I definitely remember as a kid being dropped off, you know, at the Georgia Square Mall outside of my hometown in Athens, Georgia. It was outside the perimeter, and it was like a little adult playground where I got to pretend at having money and buying food for myself and meeting up with friends and running into friends and getting my ears pierced and buying silly trinkets. But it really did feel like a space where I could bop around. And yes, it was as a consumer. And I think that is where we've been really hung up in the critique in the past. And it's a reasonable critique, you know. Yeah. Why is it that the spaces that we have for young people that feel sort of safe and enclosed are spaces for consumerism? Mm-hmm. But at this point, when consumerism is part of everything we do, it's part of our leisure time, it's part of how kids socialize, it's built into the apps we use, I think that it actually starts to look like a break from that.
in a kind of ironic way, yeah. I mean, if you're talking about the mall being a place of safety and refuge, though, we have to talk about the fact that that's probably not true for everyone. And in Phoenix in particular, the most successful malls that still stand and are still popular are kind of the very high-end ones and have been getting more and more high-end, it seems.
Yeah, I did a little research and you're exactly right. It is the high-end malls that are continuing to do well. And of course, everyone has experienced the mall differently. Mm-hmm. And safety there has always been unevenly distributed. Black and brown teenagers have long been shadowed by security, and queer and trans kids have been policed for how they dress. People who have seemed out of place, you know, unhoused, disabled, poor people were often pushed out in the name of comfort or the shopkeepers needing to make a profit. So, you know, the mall, even when it sold itself more successfully as a public square to my generation, it was always privately owned and with all the exclusions that come with that. And then the thought about how it seems to be these more elite spaces that are the ones that are continuing on, I think that's a really important one. Yeah, what would it mean if these de facto bunkers were also policed in terms of who could come inside? But I do know that it's better than, you know, a billionaire's private bunker, which is also what's being constructed right now. And I think there's also something about this idea that it's the people who sort of are able to sneer at the mall and to move on from it and to look for it in these new incarnations that look like downtown or that look like something different. Mm-hmm. These are the people with options. And I think what I really remember about the mall and what I observed in my recent visit with my family was that it really is a great place to go when you have nowhere else to go. You know, I was there with my 80-year-old father-in-law and my little kids, and we were all just taken care of for hours. I mean, there were bathrooms, there were water fountains, there was a food court. It was really low key. My nervous system at no point sounded the alarm, which is, you know, rare when I take my multi-generational family out shopping. It was surprising to me. And the level of accessibility for people who are mobility impaired, for kids who have no common sense about looking both ways before they cross a busy street. I mean, yep. That just felt really different to me in a mall.
It's interesting. All right. A new way to look at malls. That is Elizabeth Dyer, a psychotherapist and writer, talking about malls as bunkers in the future. Elizabeth, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Lauren.
Well, thank you for spending your Wednesday morning with us here on the show. If you're traveling this holiday, travel safely. And wherever you'll be, we wish you good company and stretchy waistbands. We are so thankful for you joining us here every weekday morning. We'll be back with an all-new episode of the show on Monday at 9 a.m. For Mark Brody, Lauren Gilger, and our whole team, have a happy Thanksgiving. We will talk to you then.